So one of the benefits of being old and decrepit is you get to wear glasses and have a cheat sheet here. So we're going to try to do this with a little bit of humor and try to have some fun. And we're going to make sure that all the agency folks out there don't care about politics and all the politicians don't care about the agency folks. So we're just going to try to tell it like it is to try to move this thing along so we can figure out how to get science into policy. And as probably almost everybody here knows, that the Cook Inlet fisheries are getting canceled and getting shut down, and they're struggling a lot. So this might be the perfect time to get attention to what we're trying to do here. We can try to get science to be front and center. And realistically, it'll be really difficult for all of us to just do it on our own. So getting together with this organization and trying to come up with some ideas and some contacts is a big part of all this stuff. We'd like to have an interactive discussion with the audience. Everybody up here will be introduced and they'll kind of say who they are, and I'll ask them a question to get started. But the whole idea here isn't for us to make a statement, it's for you guys to ask how we can do this, and that's a big part of it. So I'll just ask each panelist to introduce themselves and tell us who they are, what they've been up to, and then we'll get some questions going. So we'll just start with Peter.
Thank you. My name is Peter Machicki, and I'm currently the mayor of the Kennett Peninsula Borough. And as many of you know, I've done a lot of things over the years that have tied me to fisheries and policy management.
Hi, I'm Sue Mauger. I am the Science and Executive Director of the Cook Inlet Keeper, and have spent most of my time in the Keeper doing a lot of stream temperature related work and trying to understand how our salmon streams are being impacted by our changing climate.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Robert Ruffner. I am presently the Planning Director for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. And relevant to this, translating science into policy, a couple of venues that I worked in is I was the director for the Kenai Watershed Forum for about not quite 20 years, and then did a stint on the Board of Fisheries. So all those are pretty relevant to taking science and putting it into policy.
And coordinator for the partnership for the Kenai Peninsula Fish Habitat Partnership for a while, too. Thanks, Sue.
Hi everyone, I'm Cooley Walker. I'm the manager of the Ketchumek Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve, and I'm a watershed ecologist, and so you heard a little bit about what I do, but mostly trying to understand how watersheds are connected and how they support salmon streams, the science part of it, and more recently, really trying to communicate that with decision makers. You guys better use that one.
My name is Jan Kaiser. I'm the Public Works Director and the City Engineer for the City of Homer. I've been there for about 3 years now. And fun fact, I was Homer's first City Engineer over 35 years ago, so it's very interesting to see what's changed and what has not changed in that time. And so I'm back now to fix some of the things that need to be fixed. I don't know much about science, but I know a lot about policy making, and I enjoy working with these two ladies next to me who are helping me learn the science so that I can implement that into policy.
My name is Catherine Shakey, and I work for Homer's Water Conservation District. I'm the coordinator for the Kenai Peninsula Cooperative Invasive Species Management Area, also called the CISMA. And we work with federal and state partners and nonprofits, tribal entities, to focus on invasive species management at a regional landscape level scale. I'm also a steering committee member for the Fish Habitat Partnership.
Okay, there you go. So you guys have to kind of keep track of your questions as we go along so you know which ones you want to torture. So Cooey, it just doesn't work to go throwing good science out there and hope it lands on the policymakers' heads. So, why are we here?
So, Lynn asked me that question because this is a dream of mine to have these folks here, so thanks everyone. And the way I, the, the way it came forefront for me was actually, you know, spending years doing presentations, writing journal articles, talking to folks that were in decision-making capacities, but not really seeing much traction in terms of those, the science getting into policy. And it was really Lynn that helped me see how to do that in a more effective way, and that meant knowing when to be there, knowing when the policies were being considered, changes to those policies, who the people were, what their backgrounds were, all the, I guess, political side of things that I'd never thought about. I just thought if you gave people good science, they'd use it, and that's not really the way it works. So that's why I wanted to have this discussion and see how we can, you know, move forward with that.
So that brings us to Peter. So how can this group, how can you tell this group how best to function and then stay informed in the, at the legislative level and, of course, now at the borough level? It's a big question.
Okay, we'll get this mic thing straight sooner. Yeah, it's a great question. It's so you have a group full of really smart people that are specialists in their field. I won't ask for a raise of hand of PhDs versus other levels of education. You're very bright, you understand the things that need to happen, and you think, why don't they just do that? We've provided this research, why doesn't it happen? What's wrong with them? And it just demonstrates a complete disconnect on the reality of politics. So I'm gonna use the HB 77 discussion as sort of and providing some understanding. New legislator, this thing came up. Many of you came to me individually. I was willing to listen. Long history of watching government make really bad decisions. I talked about that earlier with my welcome, the C-111 canal, South Florida. And I'm thinking, what can we do to avoid those same levels, the same mistakes here in Alaska? And a lot of you came to me about the problems with HB 77, passed the House, sailed through, one vote shy in the Senate, it was mine. And I just wanted to bring it back to the communities and understand what the issues were. It was a very unpleasant experience for me, not collecting the data, but bringing it back to Juneau and killing that bill was extremely unpleasant. Lost friends, lost supporters, an enormous amount of pressure from lobbyists and industry. It's difficult as a new legislator to have not only the courage, but the willingness to listen to the science to come back and force a decision like that. So here's what you all don't do well. You are terrible political strategists. You're terrible. And the reason I'm still interested in serving on the Fish Habitat Partnership is I think I can help. I think I can help a lot of you. I know how frustrated the scientists in the room are, particularly those in state agencies, that I'm well aware of how muzzled you are when it comes to making the right decisions for Alaska, and it's got to be frustrating. So I think we need to bring people together and strategize on how to make science the primary data point in policymaking going forward.
Throw that down there, Robert, would you? So Robert, you've been on both sides as a scientist and a policymaker. What advice do you have for people on how to advance science into policy? It's just a light question.
All right, so advice that I might offer on how to get science into policy. Well, you know, I would concur with Mayor Bachicki's statement there about that I still call myself part of a we here in this group, that, you know, we haven't done well at that. I mean, there are a few examples that I could point to in my career where I think they were successful. One of the things I guess that I would say is that that the folks in your position that want to advance a particular policy item based on science is just the recognition that when you bring that forward, there are always going to be competing interests, and those competing interests are, you know, there's going to be winners and losers at the end of that. And I think one of the things that has been helpful, at least in the things that I've been successful in, is having some level of persistence in being able to bring things forward, is not giving up. So maybe an example that I would point to early on was, you know, when we discovered the amount of gasoline that was in the Kenai River, and, you know, trying to work that through all levels of government to get it to where we actually did something, you know, put something into policy and said, okay, we're going to do something that results in cleaner water. And so I think part of what we lack is taking those messages and being creative with them. So I can remember with that particular issue, standing in front of the mayor at Kenai at the time saying, yes, this is a big deal. If I was to stand on the bridge at Soldotna and throw a 55-gallon drum of gas off the bridge every 2 hours, it wouldn't be long before I'd be hauled off in handcuffs. And so coming up with creative ways to deliver that message so that people can understand, oh, this is a serious issue, and put it in terms that they understand rather than parts per billion of xylene. You know, that just does not resonate with someone that has to make a decision, but they can visualize and understand that this is the equivalent of throwing these drums of gas off the Soldotna Bridge and having it float down the Kenai. So there's an example that I could offer.
See, nothing to it. Okay, Jan, over a long time, have you seen the city of Homer change its perspective of moving science into policy? Or is it more controlled by the makeup of the council on any particular time, or what's that mix look like?
It's not so much at the council level that you see the change. The council is happy to take recommendations that are rational and make sense. It really is an effect of staff, who is the people diving deeply into the topics. And sometimes that changes over time, and sometimes attitudes don't. So let me give you an example. When I was here years ago, culverts were a big deal, drainage was a big deal, and we did a drainage management plan. But our biggest concern was where the culverts were going. So we did drainage watersheds, and we plotted out the size of culverts and so on and so forth, and we were not concerned about stuff like the effect of stormwater on groundwater, near surface groundwater, and its effect on bluff stability. We weren't interested in turbidity, we weren't interested in water quality. We didn't really have fish to worry about, so that wasn't a big concern. So all we were really interested in was water volume. So flash forward 35 years, and I get all these scientists around me talking about water quality and the effect of turbidity on Kachemak Bay and the importance of this and that and blah, blah, blah. I'm going, holy cow. Well, how can I use this information? And first of all, I had to understand it. And the mayor said that you guys aren't really good at political strategy. Well, you're also not always very good at communicating because we don't understand you. I had this guy come into my office about a month or two after I started working. And he's this traditional, wide-eyed, mad scientist-looking kind of guy, hair all askew and sneakers, walking through the wet, slushy snow, and sits down and starts jabbering. And I finally figured out that he said, well, my name is Jeff Coble. Some of you may know him, right? And he starts jabbering about all these different problems the city of Homer has and all these ideas. He's just jabbering. For 45 minutes, I just sit there and let him jabber. And after a while, I can start kind of see things in my mind about straight lines. He's not speaking in straight lines. And I get up to my whiteboard and I say, this is what I hear you saying. We have these problems. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I went up to 12. And I'm hearing you say that these top three are our highest priorities. Is that right? Well, yeah. And I'm hearing you say we can do something about these, right? And you can help us. Is that right? Yeah, okay, let's get down to business. And I had to sort of translate what he was saying into something I could work with. Now, the good thing about Cooey and her people at the Research Reserve is they helped me with the translation. And Catherine and her people at Homer Soil and Water, they helped me too. And if I get off track, they say, no, here's what we mean. And it's okay for me to say, I didn't get that. And I love that the collaboration we have built up in Homer between me as a policymaker and the scientist, but it took us a while to learn how to speak to each other. We got a young woman back here, Casey, who's gonna help us with an invasive species problem using a chicken tractor. Now, how cool is that? I got my whole city council now all excited about chickens. Because if this works, it means we won't have to use chemical herbicides on invasive species control in our roadside ditches. So you gotta learn to communicate with your policymakers, help them understand what you're talking about and what the implications are, and that's how you get along with it, Lynn.
See, I told you there's nothing to it. So in case you haven't figured that out in that little brief presentation, Jan's become quite a shiny object to us down in the home area. So Sue, this time, could you relate some of your successes in regards to getting science into policy? I know the Cook and the Keeper's been around for a long time, and it has its ups and downs with in the political world, but have you had some successes that you want to gloat about?
Actually, what I'd like to talk about is an effort through the MATSU Salmon Habitat Partnership that was really trying to address this question of, and it was very, it wasn't philosophical, it was very much about, like, literally, how do you get information to someone who's trying to make a permitting decision that would impact fish habitat. And we didn't want to do it in a reactive to some particular project because then everybody's back is up. And we wanted to do it in a proactive way. And so we worked, and I'll give a shout out to Jessica Speed, who's the coordinator for the MATSU partnership, who really helped usher this through. But we held a whole series of conversations with people who were engaged in sort of that part of the salmon system, that who had data that might be relevant, that had people who needed information to make their decisions. And it wasn't so much about policy as just infusing science into decision making. Like the policy framework is already there. And it was a fascinating, I wish we had had some sociologists around that, because I think there was a really great study there of a bunch of people who work on the same issues, and in some cases we focus this on the Deshka River, which is the biggest producer of Chinook in the Susitna River drainage. And it's a very warm system. And we had lots of data and have written papers that we made sure the local biologist had. And I think that model of like, well, you just create your literature and then you've done your job as a scientist is just such an old way of thinking, because our data now is so much more visual, robust, dense. We do a lot of mapping, and you cannot translate the real learnings from a huge data set that you've shown on a map without showing that map. And you don't see that in your journal article. It is not dynamic. You can't like put things on and off to help you answer your questions. And so realizing that there's a whole data transfer, and this question came up this morning about like, well, how do I get your data? How do I see it, right? And for most of us, it's like, well, if you come to my office, and I had a fabulous early days of thermal imagery with Lynn coming to the office and sitting in front of our GIS computer and having like an awesome time like understanding that river. But that's really not very practical. And so we're beginning to understand the ways that we can bring outside of the state agency, how we can use the AK mapper as a location, which is what the fish biologists use to make their permitting decisions. It's on their desktop, and they can bring our files if we put them into AK mapper. We can link it, and they can actually do all the playing around that they want on their desktop. But none of us knew that that was where the intersection needed to happen. And And it gave me a great deal of compassion for the fish biologist who has, you know, 20 permits to do a week, and he's only got so much information to go from. They'd be more than happy to consider more information. They just don't have it at their fingertips. And so I think as scientists, we're beginning to ask those questions a little more specifically, like, how do you take in information? And it's not the way that we typically have given it to them. So there's a little fault on both sides of those conversations where we're just not really having those deep dive conversations in a non-confrontational moment when we can just be very solution oriented. So that's been a really wonderful series of conversations we've had through the MatSU partnership. And when I've thought about bringing them here to the Kenai, it's actually a whole, we don't have Fish and Wildlife Service as a significant landowner in the MatSU. We don't have the Forest Service. So we'd actually have to have a whole series of new conversations because of new landowners to bring into it. But I think these partnership framework is a great place to really pull those issues apart at this regional scale.
Okay, Catherine, it's your turn. Invasive species, I'm sure there's never been a problem getting invasive species in the policy. Have you tried that yet, and has it worked?
Oh, it's all perfect already. I think that for myself and for the partnership that I represent, the CISMA, Cooperative Invasive Species Management Area, it's about relationship building. We work with a variety of partners, and they all encounter their own obstacles to even implementing management that they might want to implement or access to resources. So, and I think building relationships with those people who have an interest and care about invasive species management has allowed us to learn more about what things are like on their side, identify those obstacles, and then pursue them. So here are a few examples. We have the Kenai Peninsula and the Anchorage CISMA have lists of plants that we know are problematic, clearly threaten fish and wildlife habitat, and it's the Division of Agriculture's job to maintain a prohibited and noxious weed list. And those plants are then illegal to sell or trade or transport. And that list has not been updated in over a decade. And we send letters and we request that list be updated, and it has not been updated. And we know that there's a lack of resources within the Division of Agriculture, so we patiently work with the folks who are there. But one thing that became clear to me early on is that it needed to be elevated to a higher level beyond just the peninsula. So we have a very strong statewide partnership, the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership, and they worked for many years, have been working with different representatives and legislators to introduce legislation for an invasive species council. The idea being to get agency leads, commissioners, to understand some of these problems and talk to each other from the top. So that actually may be happening soon, but not through legislation, but through a governor-appointed council. So we'll see if that happens. But I think that's worth it to keep in mind. This is the long game. Build those relationships, continue the messaging. And in the meantime, we also work with the Department of Transportation very closely, and we have a couple of folks in that agency who are champions themselves in trying to, you know, waive permitting fees for us, for example, for implementing on-the-ground management. But fundamentally, they know that their agency should be managing invasive species on their own properties and parcels, and they aren't. And they learn about why they aren't, come back and tell us, and we find ways we could partner, and we talk about how can we creatively support funding, and in the meantime, try to streamline the action on the ground so that that's still happening. But there have been small fixes within regulation frameworks. So maybe it's not policy, perhaps, but regulation shifts that have allowed agencies to be more nimble in invasive species response that exist because of this network of relationships.
Okay, it's almost your turn to ask questions. So I know a lot of you over the years have probably have interdepartmental reasons you can't push to get science into policy. We have scientists that I've been listening to for years with the fish boards and the game boards expressing frustration trying to get what's supposed to be taken care of their resources, and they get political answers. And so we have scientists up here that are trying to learn how to do that, to get that science into policy. And we have politicians up here telling you, you guys aren't real good at that. And so now's your chance to ask some questions and see if we can find a path forward, because it's been frustrating for all parties. So we probably open the floor up for questions.
I had a question, I guess it's for Peter, and I didn't know, Peter, that you were so involved in killing HB-77. I want to thank you for that. And I think it's kind of a success story, that particular piece of legislation, which basically was the bill to eliminate tribes and everyday citizens from applying for instant flow water reservations, if I had that correct. And they've tried to bring that up several times in the legislature. And then when that didn't work, they tried to bring it in through the back door about 2 years ago by turning it into regulations under the current administration. And it just all of a sudden didn't go anywhere. And I don't know if you have any insights, if you've been continuing to follow the issues as to why that happened. And it seems like it was a success story, so it would be nice to know if there's any insights on how that occurred.
So I'll start by saying the most successful legislators are the ones where things happen and you just don't know how they happen. Because every act that you take, every action in the legislature has an equal and opposite reaction. Your job is to be able to have the relationships where you can be successful with essentially most sides of most issues. And that's, there are some watchdogs that, I mean, if I was going to give advice on how you could all be more successful, it's showing up more often, not just when a bill like this comes up. You need to show up. People need to know who you are. They need to have a relationship with you. You have to find ways to create an understanding with those policymakers so that they will listen. They'll realize that you're not, what would they title some of you as, left-wing whack job greenies or something. They have to respect you as a person for what you represent. You have to find a way to sell the message in a way that they would appreciate. That's the only way that you're going to create champions. And when you choose champions, make sure they're champions that can actually get something done. Often people come down with bills and they hand it to someone that has a very low probability of making it across the finish line, and that's the nicest way I can say that. And then you have to become that resource. So I will tell you, how many of you know Lindsey Bloom? Lindsey Bloom has that relationship. People open doors for Lindsey Bloom. Lindsey Bloom is a force to reckon. She's this big, but she's a force to reckon with. She's when a bill would be moving along and I would think everything was fine and Lindsey would show up, I would think, uh-oh, I'm missing something. And we had that kind of relationship. And I think, so there are forces that occur in public policy with certain legislators that keep bad things from happening. It's tougher to make good things happen than it is to keep bad things from happening. But she's a great example of someone that more of, and I don't mean that you guys do a terrible job at it, but it is complicated because it's not apparent what makes things happen in the political process. It just simply isn't. And I made a joke earlier today that the best if you look at how decisions are made recently in Alaska politics, the best grant you can ask for is one that provides campaign contributions for certain individuals, because it seems to be kind of the way things work. You have to overpower that. You don't have that level of funding. You have to have a relationship where you have the same relationship with legislators or other policymakers than that lobbyist does or that contributor does. You have to have an equal one-on-one relationship built on respect and acknowledgement for what you have to offer, and then people will listen. But you can't just do it once every 2 years when a bad bill shows up. It has to be a maintenance relationship. It has to occur all the time. They have to know that when you walk in, they're like, uh-oh. Love her, but I have a feeling that I missed something, you know? It's important. Yeah. Now, a lot of people just show up when it's time for certain things. They're not effective. You have to be a part of the process all the way along the way.
Questions? So I really appreciate this conversation. One reflection I would say from the university and the students I'm seeing, I think the shift, certainly since when I was going through, students no longer just want to publish a paper to get a degree and get a job. They want to change the world. They really do. And so having some tangibles of how to make the biggest difference is really useful. So I'm encouraged by that, of what's coming. There was a time when, you know, being involved in anything that was policy or politics as a scientist was terrible. If you're being labeled an advocate, you're on the wrong team. And those things are changing, which is good. I guess my real question, though, is my biggest concern, I guess, is not creating new policies, but the ones that we have on the books that are beautifully written are the envy of the world and just aren't followed. So what is your advice on what pressure can we put on people that should be following the law of the lands and the policies that are written as beautiful policy? That's just not happening. So separate from litigation, or voting for the right people. I mean, we do have those. I mean, I think most people in this room vote. But that's what's really been on my mind recently, is that we've got a lot of the good policy in place and we're just not following it.
Was that aimed at somebody in particular?
Any of the presumed policy makers and people that are involved in that work, what's your advice of holding feet to fire? I mean, the most beautifully written policy is worthless if you don't follow it.
Lynn, let me take a first crack at that. So at the city, we have zoning codes and we have a lot of management plans for this, that, and the other thing. Some of them going back to when I was there 30 some years ago. And there was a lot of good work done on those. And not a lot was done after that to codify that stuff. So our planning director is very fond of saying, well, we don't have code for that, when I ask him why we can't enforce such and such. And I'm thinking, you've had this design report, or you've had this management plan, or you've had these recommendations for the past 35 years, why the hell don't we have code for that by now? So sometimes it's just getting the right staff member to have impetus to actually do something about it. And that really is about building the relationship. Sometimes it's getting the right person, but sometimes it really is about building the relationship. These folks are all right about that. So Catherine shows up, somebody from Soil and Water shows up and says, maybe it was Casey. Casey, stand up so people can see who you are since I've been talking about you. So I get this communication from Casey talking about these invasive weed infestation on some city road. And she wants to know if it's okay to go spray some herbicide. And that's really the last thing I want to have to deal with right now, right? Because I got all this other stuff and I really don't care about this because it's just this tiny little section of road. And who is this person and what is this stuff and what exactly are you going to spray on the road? But she comes in and she talks about it, and Catherine talks about it, and Kyra talks about it, and they all talk about it, and they made it easy for me to say yes. So we now have this nice little section of grubstake, which is free of orange hawkweed. So then they took it up a step. Catherine comes back and says, well, how about we do this, that, and the other thing? Oh, well, I've already been indoctrinated by Casey. Okay, I guess we could do that. And I guess she made it easy for me to say yes. Yeah, we were taking strawberries, and Catherine goes, well, why can't we do it? Well, we could do that. They seduced me into saying yes by building the relationship. And they've been at me now for 3 years. So as a result of that, we now have an invasive pest management plan, and we have a certified gravel, weed-free gravel program with our uptight pinhead redneck gravel suppliers in the neighborhood. And we're about ready to do this chicken tractor. And I don't know what else you've conned me into, but it's all working out beautifully. And it's about building the relationships. I trust them. because they took the time to get to know me, to explain to me what their concerns were, and make it easy for me to say yes. And I think that's what you got to help your staff in the agencies do, is help them say yes.
Geez, Robert, I don't know if you want to follow that or...
Sure, I'll take a stab at it, but I think it's going to be the same message that that relationship component of it is maybe even more important in a policy that has precedent of being ignored. So I can remember early on, you know, being on the Board of Fisheries and thinking, oh, I got it. You know, here's the sustainable salmon policy. It's got all the elements of everything I need to use. I just got to pull them out and start exercising them. But there's a precedent of ignoring elements of that particular policy and that I can remember.
That one hadn't come to mind.
I didn't think it was in the forefront. But there is a precedent there, so it's even harder to overcome. You know, with something new, you know, people have like, oh, we're excited about this, we're gonna put this into play. But the discussions I had behind the line at the Board of Fisheries with that was like, oh, we've never done that. You don't want to open that can of worms. And without having a lobby of equal proportion pushing on the decision makers with those relationships to exercise some of those policies, it doesn't happen. So again, I think I'm repeating what several people have said, is that the folks that are effective at those types of venues are the ones that you know on a first name basis and are there all the time. So that's an important point, and it also applies to policy.
I am not going to say the same thing, because so how many people in this room have been to Juneau to talk to a legislator about some policy? 5-10% maybe. So that's part of the challenge in this. I totally agree that relationships that's how we write. We need to trust. We need to. I've met a bunch of people here today, and it's like, oh, I've never actually met you in person. No, this, and you feel this connection suddenly that is much deeper than Zoom or the phone will ever give you. But if we just rely on Alaskans having to take days off away from the family to go down to Juneau to advocate for something, or that they have to sit at the Board of Fish meeting for 2 weeks to have any kind of influence in fisheries management, I would say that's not an effective public process. And it definitely marginalizes an awful lot of people who do not have the resources to travel to go and meet with their legislator. And I think for many of us, we've had experiences where, oh great, you know, our legislator's coming to talk to us, we're gonna have an open house, and the first 45 minutes of the hour is them telling us how great they are at the job. And that opportunity for real listening isn't necessarily happening both ways. And so I guess I'm gonna throw a little thing at I understand the local, like if you can go and walk down to Jan's office and Jan, I'm embarrassed that we don't know each other, and that will be fixed. But I do think that there's a little bit of caveat about this idea that you have to have like deep personal relationships with people who live, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, and how you do that. And so maybe I will throw that back out to those who, you know, you've been on the Board of Fish and you've been down in Juneau. Other than those who have the money to go and do those in-person opportunities, what is the most effective way for you to engage? Am I talking too long? Sorry.
You're doing great.
Can I?
Yeah, I want it back.
So I'm sorry. There must have been a misunderstanding, because you're absolutely supporting my very point. A relationship doesn't occur in Juneau. It occurs every day. So it's not about some distant person hundreds of miles away with a $600 round trip ticket. It's about having that relationship. I've had a relationship for years with many people in your organization that I talk to regularly that help provide a wake up or a conscience. I hardly ever see them. I see them periodically at people all over the state, some of which I've never met, that provide that level of data and sometimes a conscience or an awakening of something that I haven't seen coming. You are saying the same thing I am saying in a different way. What I will tell you is waving signs on a corner and yelling things at legislators that you see once a year is completely ineffective because they see others every day. So I'm gonna disagree sometimes, and I don't know that we are. Those relationships are imperative to moving issues forward that we want to move forward. They're imperative. And it's not a daily thing, it's just a thing. And when it doesn't occur, you will not be successful because they've got people in their face all the time. And we can't compete on that level. We can't compete with hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars in campaign contributions. We have to compete with information, science, and FaceTime or voice time until they know us when we call.
Can I say something? Okay. So I mean, I agree with everything that's being said about relationships, and jumped right into this with working with the borough and the material site extraction code and making that effort to go up and be there regularly even when I wasn't speaking. And I realized the value of that in-person relationship. I also realized that, you know, it's really hard to do that all the time for all the reasons we've just talked about. And so something that I've been thinking about, a little bit more context, as a reserve manager, I go to D.C. every year and I meet with our congressional staff folks, Murkowski, Sullivan, Young when he was there. And that's super valuable, I've learned, even those once a year in-person meetings, because then they remember you can email them and you can talk and you have those conversations. So anyway, all the context I'm saying is leading up to this idea of having somebody who's like a legislative liaison, maybe for the partnership, maybe that position is paid for through some kind of, you know, communal partnership funding, because it's really hard to do your regular job and keep track of all the legislation and all the people who are involved and their backgrounds and what's going on in their lives that might make them receptive or not or all that stuff. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I've been thinking about it. This idea that the partnership could support some kind of liaison that would then connect. I'm not going to say be a lobbyist, but be a liaison.
Lynn, can I say something?
No. Okay. You're going to.
She's
gonna
anyway.
Sure, you're going to speak.
I'm going to anyway. Another thing you can do is help them, the policymakers. If you discover that they are interested in something and you have information that could help them, help them. One of the things I love about Homer Soil and Water is that when I want to follow up on my stormwater management programming. I call Homer Soil and Water and I say, I need help with us as such, and they send out Patrick and Casey and Catherine to help me. And so I have all those additional resources to get stuff done, and I really like that. And I say, Chloe, I've got this problem with my water reservoir. I want to know how long it's going to last. And she says, I got a program for you. So they are resources that help me, and so that bill helps build the two-way trust and relationship.
So working with multiple different agencies and seeing the individuals who make decisions that sometimes put them out on a limb. So I'm thinking of incorporating best management practices into a construction project, you know, requiring your contractor to clean their equipment and have it inspected. You know, state parks down in Kechemek Bay, they don't have a lot of resources, but Jason Oakley decided to write into their contract for work on HE land across the bay that they have to have their equipment cleaned, inspected, and they are responsible for invasive plant cleanup for, you know, 5 years after this, which we modeled after the Kenai Refuge, thank you, and your larger highway project that you and worked with DOT to basically make sure that they are cleaning up any invasives they bring in. But as a result, someone from my office runs down and inspects the equipment that HEA is staged at the dock before it goes across the bay. So that was a decision that one person saw an opportunity because they were aware of that as a tool and put it into a contract. And I'm seeing that with other federal agencies happening as well. But then I also am seeing a culture in a lot of our state agencies, I feel like I can say this because I'm a quasi-state agency, where that's not encouraged if people don't feel supported to make those decisions. So if you're going to be laughed at for suggesting doing something differently, that's not helping any of this process. We need a culture where it's okay to for folks to come in and offer change. I don't know how that's role modeled at the top, but there are a lot of people mid-level career who are really tapped into resources across the state, and there's a lot of consensus, I think, on management practices, and those resources are there, but they're just not being taken advantage of. So I do think there's something from the top that needs to happen as well.
More questions?
Hi. So I'm a state employee. I work for Fish and Game, and I often feel like my hands are tied in the political process. Like, I can't have a voice because my boss, that's his, like, he's the voice. So I very much like Cooley's idea of like a Fish Habitat Partnership liaison to go be the communicator. So I'm just kind of curious, do you see, like, the politicians on your level, do you see state agency employees coming to your office? Like, is there any avenue for us? Or are they remaining, anonymous?
Finally, an agency person spoke up, forgot about politics, and yeah, that was my... I'll let Peter grab this, but my comment to you guys was, I saw a few hands go up when Sue asked who'd been down lobbying and working with the legislators, and the rude reality is when you guys start to put your budgets together and your timelines together, you're going to have to address what Peter was talking about and what everybody's talking about. You're going to have a way to go through the system and put time in, or that science just kind of struggles.
So that's a great question. I won't have the camera point at you or get your name or anything. Could affect your future. So if you ask, and I hope I have the same reputation as the Kenai Peninsula Borough, many mid and I will say mid on up level employees in the various agencies. I kind of served as that messenger of folks that I built a relationship with throughout the organization, 22,000 employees. There would be someone in each department that folks would kind of give the courage to come say hello. And then I built a reputation of a guy they can come to that wouldn't rat them out. And we got some cool things done in the various departments. I mean, that's why I say if you create champions that can be successful, had control over a lot of budgets. So I'd go in and say, you know what, deputy commissioner or commissioner, I think this is a pretty good idea. And I want to see it happen. And it would happen. So that's part of that trusted relationship thing. And I can help with a few names that I think are either capable of will be capable of that level of deliverability in the future. But you guys are muzzled. It's obvious that you are muzzled throughout the system. It's obvious who whispers to whom when these processes are occurring. So you have to find a way. You have to find a way to get your message to the right person that can make a difference. And the legislature controls the purse strings, so they can make a difference. If I suggest something and I back it up with data, that should probably happen in that department. And I let them know that this other thing that's important to them may go away. If we can't come to agreement, we come to agreement. So that's part of what effective legislators do, is they know what really matters to a commissioner. And they help them understand some things that should matter to them as well. And it's just how the system works. So finding someone you can trust that's going to share that message and make things happen is pretty important. But it's equally important with non-state employees. It's just that not people that aren't state employees don't have that same pressure, and I've seen it in every process. And I'm sorry you're living through that. Hopefully someday there'll be a more open administration on certain things. And but you got to find a way. I don't know how you would retain your sanity if you don't find a way to make the good things happen.
So there must be at least one other agency person brave enough to stand up and say, wow, what goes on in my organization? I have good science, but how do I move it forward? We're lucky to have somebody with the experience that Peter's had in Juneau, and he represents this group. So, you know, use that experience and tap on him when you have to, and I'm sure he'll give you his home phone number.
I think most of them probably
maybe
already have it.
Anyway, do we have more questions? Okay, we did it. Any more comments from you quiet folks up here?
We're all strapped for time. I mean, I would love to put more energy into something like this, and I don't have time to think about it. I think about it during these symposiums, and that's all I can afford. So I would like this idea of a legislative liaison or a some sort of way to fund time for people to come together and spend more time brainstorming about this and support each other. I'm not sure how we make that work, but.
So Catherine and I are both on the steering committee for the partnership, and so we know we meet regularly and we talk, we all share updates and we talk about proposals and, you know, funding of proposals, but there could be a way to also talk about legislation, and if there was somebody there, we could kind of prioritize, like, okay, well, this is, you know, here's the state of the science, and then that, anyway, that we can communicate through a person, because we all are really busy. I mean, we know it's super important, and we get that if we have to have those relationships, and we have to find a way to communicate. But it's really hard when it's not your job to find that time.
I'd like to add something. It's hard. I know it's hard for you scientists out there, but stay with it, because it will be worth it. At some magic moment in time, you will find someone who will listen. It took Jeff Coble 12 years of coming back to the city, year after year after year, until he finally found an open ear, and now we are rocking and rolling. It'll take time, but it will be worth it.
We're so glad you're there.
Okay, thank you guys very much for listening to us.